Friends, I have lived with this occasion for a year and three quarters, and very often have talked with you in my imagination in many different circumstances. And I feel a good deal of embarrassment and unease standing here now, not only because I feel very much as though I have at last been brought to the point of execution, but also because I'm standing with a straight back and empty hands, whereas most of my preparation has been done with a hoe in my hand and a bent back and the sweat dripping into my eyes. And maybe that is a useful symbol for us to bear in mind at the beginning, that we are here detached for a moment from the business of living, and that each one of us is going to go back very shortly into the world where we are going to try to plow in something of that which we have glimpsed during these few days together. This is a withdrawal temporarily in order that we may live and live more abundantly and help others to do so too. I want to say at the very beginning how short my horizon is. I am addressing us in this room this week. I have no intention of speaking to the wider Quaker world through our editors, nor to the wider world beyond. I conceive my purpose as intended to be to try as far as I can to formulate something of the strivings and seekings which each one of us has for this conference. If the planning committee had wanted a great prophetic utterance on this occasion, they would not have invited me. I think they wanted someone who perhaps speaks too readily, but tries to express in the language of the ordinary friend the things that the ordinary friend is seeking to express. And this is all that I intend to do. But I want you to enter fully into this exercise. And to do this, I invite each one of you personally to imagine yourselves standing in my shoes at this moment. And I'm sorry if you find it uncomfortable. I assure you, no more so than I, who've had time to realize just how uncomfortable it is. Stand here and look out. And now let your imagination run and think of the differences amongst us. Go for a journey, a quick journey. Start somewhere. Let's start in Alaska. It's a good place. The last issue, previous issue of our handbook tells us that when quarterly meeting is due, dog teams begin to arrive from every direction. Come through the wide open spaces of Canada and the Midwest of America and down to here. And what have you passed through? In the yearly meeting epistles which come to London Yearly Meeting, there are references to pastors who are called Reverend. There are references to altar services. There is an unease about peace and the work of the service committee. And also you have passed through areas where these things seem strange and incomprehensible. Go on around the world. I won't take you, and think of the diversity realize how differently we think about nearly everything that matters most to us. How differently we think about what matters most. In your mind's eye, think of how we think about God, of the significance which we attach to Jesus Christ, of the authority with which we endow the Scripture, of our ways of worship, of our attitude to the peace testimony and to social testimonies. And on none of these things could you say all friends think alike. We come with differences of cultural background, of nationality, of race, of previous religion, of language, and differences of that kind. And you are standing here, asked to say something. And now let me tell you the worst, that when Ed Bronner talked with me originally about this, the terms of reference which he gave were, I quote, to set the tone of the conference. And just in order to turn the knife in the wound, in a recent letter, he referred to the keynote address. Friends, this is your responsibility at this moment. Now, do you think I have asked you to stand here simply because I'm filled with self-pity? I am, but never mind. The real reason, of course, is this, that there is only one person who can set the tone of this conference, and that is you. It is in our relationships one with another, as we meet out on the campus, over meals, in our group discussion, in what we bring to those encounters and what we take from them, in receptivity and faithfulness, that the tone of this gathering is going to be made or lost. In what we say and what we do not say, and most of all in how we say it, that things are going to happen for good or for ill. But there is not only a problem of diversity. There is a sense of oneness which we already know together. And this is something difficult to put into words. I found a clue when my eye happened on a review of that, to me, very remarkable book by Daisy Newman entitled Diligence in Love. A book written 16 years ago, giving the impact on a very sophisticated American businesswoman of encounter with a section of New England Quakerism. And the reviewer said that friends in the Midwest would find the unprogrammed meetings there described very unfamiliar, but they would at once be at home with the friends who were characterized in that book. And I think it is at this level of at-homeness with one another, of knowing that we are all going, so to speak, in the same direction, that something of our unity is found. And this is found because we have a common purpose, even though our means of achieving it are so varied. And the other point of unity, which I think has been most in my mind, is in the life and person and spirit of John Woolman, whom every one of us would recognize as having the root of the matter in him. And so in my specific preparation for this gathering, I have spent a few days in New England, and I have reread John Woolman's journal. I want now to turn quite specifically and directly to our attitudes to one another. There are several possible ones. There is the attitude which can be described as having so firm a conviction of truth that we have a compulsion to share it with one another. Woe unto me if I preach not the gospel. It tends to be rather of the character of one-way proclamation, something which means so much that I must share it at all costs. More of proclamation than of listening. And this has a very good background. It is the mood of the Book of Acts, and it is certainly the mood of 17th century Quakerism. And I think it was the mood of friends towards one another in the days of our divisions. London Yearly Meeting had the truth, and it was prepared to proclaim it to the poor benighted friends in the General Conference, but that was rather the attitude. And perhaps we still have something of that. And then there was another attitude which grew up in the interwar years, an attitude which was receptive, which was humble, which sought to be open to new light from whatever quarter it might come, which tended to minimize difference in order to come close and to listen and to understand. And this has enabled us to come much closer to one another and has led us to the point where we say to one another that the friends of the Evangelical Alliance say one thing, and the friends of the United Meeting say another, and the friends of the General Conference say yet another, but of course we're all friends. And this has been a good thing as far as it goes, because it has brought us together to this point where, as we heard last night, we are a more representative group of friends from all the world than ever has been before. And this has been the mood of friends in the World Quaker setting over the last 30, 40 years. But I venture to think that we must move on beyond either of those attitudes, each of which is in its own way relatively easy, into another which is more difficult. It is possible to recognize that sameness is death, that difference involves tension, which may be destructive but may be very creative. And I am asking you at this point, willingly and with your eyes wide open, to try to develop an attitude which I'm going to describe in the words creative encounter, an attitude which combines the positives of both of the others, which is genuinely humble, genuinely receptive, genuinely seeking to understand a point of view which is alien to us, and at the same time to try to be faithful to the truth that we have known, not to lean over backwards for the sake of a superficial unity, but to speak the truth as we have known it. And I want to suggest that this is, in fact, the only attitude which is consistent with our Quaker belief. Because if we truly believe in that of God in every man, this surely means that we are going to seek for his guidance through the experience and insight of every other man, and also in faithfulness to that which we have known directly in our own hearts. And so I believe we are called at this stage to move forward into an attitude which combines tolerance and understanding with faithfulness, an exercise in charity and faithfulness. But this, friends, is very much harder than it sounds. And I want to say right now that if we can do what I'm asking, this will be no picnic. This kind of encounter hurts, and hurts horribly. I don't think anything has hurt me more in the last months than a continuing struggle to understand and to communicate truth with my best friend. Because truth and love are part of one whole and cannot live without each other. And suppression of truth is patronizing. It implies that we can take this, but he can't. And there is no room for patronage in love. And I believe we're close enough together now in the world society to take for granted this real caring one for another, and to reach out in the exercise of faithfulness, which is the opportunity for something creative to happen. Now, matter and manner are somewhat analogous to truth and love. And a tremendous lot depends on the manner in which we convey the truth that is meaningful to us. One of my disappointments this year was in seeking desperately to hear what someone was saying. But the manner in which he said it shouted so loud that I couldn't hear the words he spoke. And this was partly because there was a fault on my side too. There was prejudice. I'm asking you to come into a relationship of tension, and tension is creative very largely according to the spirit that we bring to bear upon it and within it. Now, so far, I think, from your faces, you're with me. But it's difficult to leave things at the general point without being a little evasive. And so I'm going to exemplify. Over a year ago, a very weighty friend of London Yearly Meeting heard what my task was for this morning And he looked at me aghast. And he said, "Hugh, it's impossible. Most of them are not friends at all." And then he went on and he said, "I shall be praying for you that you will be that you will be faithful." Now, I've never known till then how uncomfortable it is to be prayed for. But whether this is an answer to prayer, I do not know. I think it is right to go on and to say this. I'm going to take one of the hoary and more obvious problems, the pastoral system. And I want to say that I have very slight personal acquaintance with it within Quaker circles. I am therefore speaking out of a measure of ignorance which is considerable. I have met a considerable number of pastors and have an immense regard and affection for many of them. I believe that through their ministry they are succeeding much more successfully than we are in London Yearly Meeting in many fields, particularly fields of outreach and of pastoral care and of religious education, that very often the life of their congregation has a cutting edge, whereas we have something that is blunt or fluffy, that there is a tremendous lot to be said for it. But, with all the prejudices of a friend of London Yearly Meeting, I have to add that in my present state of prejudice and ignorance, I believe the pastoral system to be a backward-pointing bypath off the main road of essential Quakerism, which at best leads to a blind alley, and at worst right away from that which I believe to be essential in Quakerism. Now, your faces have altered. 3/4 of you have withdrawn just a little. Many of you are feeling sorry for me in my state of ignorance. Many of you feel that this is not the moment when I should have said a thing like that. And I hardly dare to think what members of the planning committee are thinking. Let me assure you on their behalf that they did not know I was going to say this, or they might not have let me say it. But do you see what I'm saying? I believe we must try to come together, and for the reassurance of some of you, my roommate in this conference is a pastor, and if he is able to keep me awake at night, which is difficult, it may be that we shall be involved in creative encounter through this week to come. Let me go again. What I have said is trivial, I believe, compared to a much more insidious mood which is prevalent in London Yearly Meeting, a mood of vague permissiveness which affects both matters of belief and social witness and moral testimony, and which masquerades under the influence of those who are pleading for freedom of the individual, but which very easily runs from Quakerism into Runterism, which so stresses individual faithfulness and freedom that it undercuts corporate testimony. And this, I believe, is a far more serious ill in our body than the one to which I have just referred. And further, the pastoral system in itself has better defenses against it than we have. Here are our problems, and now I've lost another 20% of you, and perhaps only 5 are with me. But we must say these things, and we must come together in spirit of unity and love to wrestle with them, and then to go out to the world outside. Now I want to turn right away from ourselves, though let me just summarize, perhaps in a way, what I have said about creative encounter by saying that the words of our title might possibly be altered in order insofar as we are considering our relationships one to another. Seek, share, find, I believe may be the order while we are together looking inwardly. But if we have only come to look inwardly, I for one would not have come. Our function is surely to come here in order that we may help to make the society of friends a more finely tempered instrument in the service of the kingdom of God. That we may in our little way try to clarify our vision and see its relevance to the great world in which we are set. That this is not simply a domestic occasion, but it's an occasion when we withdraw for a few moments and straighten our backs. But when we go back and bend our backs again and sweat and toil in the world for its greater knowledge of God and His will. And I want us now to think for a moment about our attitude to the world, to look out and to realize that Quakerism has indeed a message which is relevant. I believe tremendously relevant at every point where we touch the world. Because just as there is no time but this present, so there is no situation which does not have its personal reference. And if we do honestly believe that something of God's Spirit is at work in the heart of every single human being, there is no tiny part of the world and its relationships which is secular. Every single little bit of it is of concern to us and to God. Last night, Lewis Waddilove, mentioned some of the great problems of the world in which we live, this armament race and all the rest. I'm not going to list them again. We all know them. I hope we're all living inside them all the time. But there are some which hit one more than others. In the years of the Depression, I lived in an area where poverty was such that unemployed miners and unemployed sheep vied with one another on the council refuse dump as the carts were tipping their rubbish to see if they could find anything from those garbage carts which could be eaten or used as fuel. And I little thought that 30 years later I should still be encountering this kind of degrading poverty. I have gone from the worst of the Soweto slum townships near Johannesburg into the most comfortable home that I visited in South Africa and nearly been sick by the contrast. Cheek by jowl with great affluence is great poverty. And in the beauty and glory of this campus, and I cannot speak too highly of what it has meant to me, the green of your trees and everything else, may we never for one moment forget the ghettos not far away.